It is Saturday, April 20th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 889 and KOSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I am your host, Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio is Charlie Mansky, ex-molecular biologist, Netscape engineer, and producer of Dr. Don. Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me at such a last minute. It's wonderful. So this last week of the reports of the bombings and such, one of the things that came out in the tech space is how do you stay on top of a live event like this, right? And we, of course, have 24/7 news networks, and they do cover stuff, I should say.
But quite wrong sometimes.
So, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of those things about up-to-the-minute news. One of the sources that a lot of geeks go to is actually called Reddit, and that's reddit.com. And basically, this is conceptualize it like a forum. It's an internet forum of types. People post things, and then they rank them. Everybody ranks them and adds to it, and you basically get some pretty great content. You kind of think of it as a real-time Wikipedia, right, if people understand that kind of concept.
Right.
And what's really interesting about the feed that I've got, that I'll link up from geekspeak.org, it's a few people that were basically in Boston, listening to police scanners, watching news, but very close to the scene and updating it. You see a whole bunch of see a whole bunch of posts added by date, by time, right? So 11:26 EST, they have a photo of the alleged suspect. 11:27, another note, you know, and then NBC just reported this. And so in chronological order, you have a pretty pretty effective system. Now, one of the things that occurred is that what Ben specifically said to me was the problem with it, of course, is that although Reddit has a lot of stuff going on, the spawning of several manhunts, if you will, person hunts, occurred kind of because of that fever level of editing, right? Instead of I guess what Ben's kind of getting to is that it supports a mob mentality thought process where think very quickly, act very quickly, and that kind of engaged activity can be dangerous for human beings, I would say. So it's a really interesting in the sense that it's definitely gives you great content, keeps the feed in one location. Twitter does this as well, right?
Before you get off Twitter, though, actually the PBS NewsHour last night talked to, I believe it was a blogger from Slate, who was very familiar with this, and he was talking about it, and they had a pretty good discussion about, you know, how accurate was it, and did it help the police? Is this a distraction from what the police are doing? And it was a very interesting discussion.
It's a lot of back and forth in this.
Yeah, it really was interesting. But
I want to urge people to do is that, you know, you hear about Reddit, you know that it's there. If you go to the Reddit site, you kind of have to learn the system to be functional in it. So I would recommend going to geekspeak.org, take a look at the link about Reddit. And the reason, Mark Hanford from Cruiser actually sent this off to me yesterday when I was asking for news stories. Mark used to be a regular on GeekSpeak. Actually, he started it, one of the starters. In any case, he said, you know, take a look at this one feed that you got, which is the link I've got, and then follow the multiple posts. The multiple threads occur, not the comments. The comments are who knows what level. But it's really interesting to see it because it does give the context to all the news stories you've got. So I highly recommend taking a second on the web to do that.
Cool.
All right, another thing I want to mention is that Kansas City and Austin, Texas. Know anything really special about both those places, Charlie?
Yeah. I wish I lived there for this reason.
Yeah, Google has launched fiber campaigns in these cities and kind of making fiber internet just like water and electricity. It's funny, in all the articles, it's like, just like water and electricity. And I want to say, and phones. Isn't that important? But really, it's superset phones, right? I mean, at this point, phone service isn't actually as important to a building as electricity and water and internet. And it's this is a general thing that we feel, I think, on GeekSpeak, is that internet access is at that level where if you don't have internet, you're not participating in the world at an equal level. You know, you need internet access to, I mean, the amount of resources available at your fingertips. It's almost a human right, or it should be, right? So in any case, Provo, Utah has just been added to Google's list. It's the next city to be hit with the fiber. And unlike Kansas and Austin, Provo in Provo, Google's actually buying an existing fiber network. That's probably why Provo was selected, because there was already an agency there. And it's kind of, you know, Google doing this is kind of putting the big network providers to shame.
Oh, absolutely. And absolutely. Somebody's just written a book about this whole issue, and basically the cartel of Verizon and AT&T, and how they're doing this just for profits, and they're not treating it as a utility. And I'll be happy to give my personal experience, because we will never get DSL, we will never get cable, and go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to introduce your topic. Okay. What are you doing? Because for years, you and I have chatted. You produce Dr. Don every week, and so we see each other for about 34 seconds between shows. and we talk about tech, and you're always in the situation going, network at home. And I'm like, right. Oh, yeah, I've got cable. No big deal. So you're in the mountains of Watsonville. No DSL because you're too far from the phone company situation. They didn't run cable there. And so you're in a situation where you have to either use satellite, a terrestrial service provider that has Wi-Fi beam to your house, or what you're actually choosing, I guess, right? Cell?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So there are situations where we're kind of in a little valley. So we are literally a couple of thousand feet past the DSL limit, mm-hmm. and we're in a hole. And so there are people with farmhouses a mile away that have great DSL. And so we're sort of in this like intersection, not an intersection, but a hole that probably has maybe 20 houses. And so there's stuff to the right of us, stuff to the left of us, and we don't get DSL. So that's the situation for DSL. Because we're in a valley, I checked into like three different Wi-Fi broadcasts, and we can't get them because we keep getting hills that block us.
Right.
And so we used satellite for a while. It was through Dish Network. Forget what the thing is, something blue. But anyway, that sucks.
Once
you get an HTTP connection, you can get decent download speed, so you could do like video, but it has this delay of if you do the math, because the satellites are 22,500 miles away, they're synchronous satellites, it's like a half a second for each of the little pings, the HTTP connect, the packets. Mm-hmm. And that makes very complicated websites, commercial websites, your banking site, impossible. It just makes it really slow. It feels slower than modem, old-style modem. So eventually, we did start using Verizon, and the signal was okay. You know, it was not too bad. But then about last October, magically, our rates went great. We're like 10 megabits per second.
Why do you say magically?
Because, I mean, just all of a sudden, one day, it started going really fast. Well, what it turns out was, it was a transition from 3G to 4G.
Uh-huh.
And so there really is a difference.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, right? That's what we've been hearing.
Okay. Sure. But here's the rub. Catch is, initially, we had it was like $80 for 5 gigabits gigabytes bandwidth per month. Well,
Wait. How much was it?
Five gigabytes.
5 gigabytes, and how
per month?
And that plan was expensive.
Yeah.
So basically, it's an expensive plan, and 5 gigabytes isn't enough to do everything people want. You can't watch Netflix and all that stuff.
Exactly. Certainly can't watch movies. You can barely watch. We hit the limit pretty easily, and they have high overage charges. You know, well, things have actually gotten better, and so my situation now is that we just got new cell phones, and so we're looking at new plans. And ironically, we had unlimited data with our cell phones, but had a limit on the number of calls and text messages you could have. Now they're flipped. Now they realize that the data connection is more important. So we have a shared plan which shares all of the phones. So we have three phones in the family right now, and probably are going to get one more. And then we have our internet connection, our main internet connection. So what we eventually went with is a standard Wi-Fi router that takes a modem, takes a internet, you know, basically a Verizon Pantech modem.
It's got a cell phone.
It's just like the little modems you stick into your laptops.
Okay. All right.
But the key thing is to boost the signal, I put an external antenna. And it's just a passive antenna. You can get active amplifying antennas. But just with the passive antenna, we have great reception. And with this all-in-one plan now, we have 20 gigabytes per month. So it's a lot better.
Okay, that's better. Yeah.
And it worked out, it's $150 for the data.
All right, so it's expensive. I mean, you're talking about really expensive stuff. I mean, in the sense
expensive,
that,
but at least
you have it.
At least I have it. and the side effect too is that I can keep my Wi-Fi and my phones on all the time.
Right.
Because the actual connectivity, the actual 4G signal inside the house is pretty poor. And so it would just be not reliable. And
right.
So this is our solution. So, you know, for those of you who can afford it, the sort of all-in-one share plan from Verizon actually does work if you got the money.
Now, did you take a look at our episode a couple weeks ago? Let's see, episode is the 6th. It was 2 weeks ago. I talked a bit about cell phone coverage on the West Coast, like in this area. And my friend, and you might know him too, Jim Warner, has a whole website up at UCSC where he does network analysis and stuff. And I'm linking that to today's show as well.
Oh,
it's just a really wonderful resource. You can actually participate in the plan to actually test cell phone coverage area in this area.
Hmm.
And
this
really has to do with, you know what? 2 weeks ago, listen to that episode of Geek Speak. We talked about it really well.
I didn't listen to that one,
I know how it is. I don't know. I don't catch all those Dr. Don shows, unfortunately. So in any case, that's up as well. And the show notes are being live as we go.
Cool.
So I want to mention to people, I talk to people all the time about passwords and being really good with password security. And a few weeks ago, Ben and I had this nightmare experience of Apple had this kind of bug that basically if you knew an email address and a birth date, you could log into an Apple account. And so Ben and I both made giant crazy password-like email addresses and changed our Apple IDs. They also offer a two-step authentication. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it takes a period of time to wait. So both Ben and I added ourselves to the two-step authentication, but for 6 days, we would have been vulnerable because they have a pending period for that service. And during that time, we added crazy email addresses, which was a nightmare. It made all my devices stop working. It was kind of a mess. But Apple now does have two-step authentication as well, but now I've actually used it. I've set it up. What this means, the two-step authentication or two-factor authentication, the general concept of that is that to do authentication, to know who a person is, you can know something and you can have something. And those are two different types of identity. So for example, when you go and get arrested in the police station, they will try to get your information of your name and stuff. And they also fingerprint you. And the fingerprint is, it happens to be a kind of a secret, but it's actually something you have, right? You always have it. And that's the reason we use it. That's one of the reasons. So in a two-factor authentication, you're looking for having a secret and having an object. Mm-hmm. And that just allows you that without that object, you can't log into the service. Without that secret, you can't log in. So it's very difficult, of course, because how do you ensure that someone has an object? And you probably familiar with like Secure ID when you work in Netscape. Did they have those? When I did stuff with AOL years ago, every time you logged into AOL's account, you had to have this little tiny piece of electronics that gave you a random digit thing.
Yeah, a little hardware.
It's called Secure IDs. Exactly. And basically, it's always refreshing, every 10-second refreshing number that's not random. It's generated by an algorithm. You don't know the algorithm. The company knows the algorithm, and you can check it anytime.
Right.
So that's the general concept of you have to have that object. So in this day and age, we all happen to have an object, and that is our cell phones.
Yeah. And so Google's doing this. Is that
Google does
get
this
to?
Too. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Google does this and Apple does this. And I just want to ensure that people step into that process because it is not – one of the trouble with passwords is it's not really possible for a human being to have the amount of passwords necessary to interact with the web the way it's currently designed.
Exactly.
So you have to have some kind of password management system. 1Password, LastPass, these are services that can store your passwords for you. And people think, well, I'll just think up a smart pattern and I'll use the same type of password but kind of munge it every time based on the service. Problem is, you're not as smart as 10,000 people, and that's the kind of data sets that these hacking systems have. So you can't be smart enough. So we really need to move to two-factor authentication. It just has to happen. And so this is how Google works. Google, you install an app on your phone, and it does work on multiple different smartphones. And when you do that, you authenticate that app. It gives you a random number. Every time I log in from a new location, from a place I've never logged in, or a new IP address through Google, I have to use this code generator. I have to launch my phone and look at this number. It's annoying, right? Mm-hmm. But it's very secure. Even a relatively intelligent hacker can't get into my Google account without my phone. But also, they need a secret from me. So there's two pieces. And so that makes my Google account very safe. Now, what happens?
I have a question for you, though. So do you have to do this only once for a particular computer location?
It's a timed out thing. You have to do it for there's certain rule sets that are kind of complicated, but that's the general concept. So what happens if I drop my phone in the toilet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's one of the concerns. So what happens when you first set this up is you actually can get a whole bunch of codes that will be like a one-time use, and you print them and you put them somewhere safe, right? So I have a secret space that has a couple of these. I have like 6 of these that I can use. And with that, I can re-authenticate a new phone. Okay.
Ah, okay.
So that has I have two things I have. Apple does the same thing. Apple's got the authentication, which basically they're going to be texting your phone with a code, and you have to put in that code, which is kind of neat. You don't have to run software. And then also your password. And they gave me a code that would basically be a super password that I'm not supposed to keep digitally, right? So I printed that out. Of course, it's probably cached on my printer now, and I save that as well. So that's, and so I highly recommend password. You need to start learning about two-factor authentication. Spend some time on it. It's important.
I agree. This is similar to like making bank transfers. You get the secret code sent to you on your, it's just a text message.
Yeah.
And you use that, you know, type it in. Once I get it, it expires in, you know, 5 minutes and that's it. So
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's good. It's smart. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Charlie Mansky. We put notes with further information at geekspeak.org. Next up, we have some space update from Ben and cyber threats. U.S. government. Stay with us.
Hey, Lyle. So I just thought I'd hop in here and give a little bit of space news. So first off, the Lyrid meteor shower is coming up. And that is from April 22nd to April 23rd. That evening time and morning time is about where it's going to peak. You could probably catch a couple meteors before and after that date, but you'll see the most on that date. The unfortunate part is that the moon is very full, and so we are going to get a lot of moonlight, which makes it pretty difficult to spot these things. So if anyone happens to be really into astronomy, you can wake up pretty early dawn on Tuesday morning and see a bunch of meteors. To be honest, I probably won't be watching because that's early in the morning and I'll probably be sleeping. Another pretty cool thing is that on April 24th, 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched into orbit. And that means that in 4 days, that's the 23rd anniversary of the event. And actually, to celebrate, they released an awesome image of the Horsehead Nebula. So that's up on geekspeak.org if you like awesome astronomy pictures. Another piece of space news that was pretty interesting is that there's actually a launch that's going to happen pretty soon. As of my recording of this at about midnight on April 20th, the launch is currently scheduled, I think, for April 20th at about 5 p.m. Eastern time. But of course, things like this can change very easily. So check the link at geekspeak.org for more information. This is going to be visible around Eastern Virginia. So if any of our listeners happen to be there, look up into the sky at the right time and you might actually see a launch. Of course, NASA is also going to be live streaming it. So that's pretty cool too. You can go ahead and watch it. This is going to be the Antares rocket. And once it gets to orbit, that'll mark the second entirely private commercial business to get a rocket into space. So there you have it. There's a dose of space news for you.
Well, thanks, Virtual Ben. So much appreciate that. I want to let you know that the Electronic Freedom, Frontier Foundation, I say freedom because I think of them as a freedom, but they're a legislative, a nonprofit that supports defending the your rights in the digital world. That's their motto, Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I follow them quite a bit. And their quote recently is about the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which just passed Congress, unfortunately. This is something that I did not support. I don't know if we covered it enough on Geeks, because it has not passed the Senate. And Obama has said that he's going to veto it. So it might not go forward. But the CIPA purports, this is a quote from the EFF, purports to allow companies and the federal government to share threat information for a cybersecurity purpose and to protect and defend against attacks against computer systems and networks. But the bill is actually written kind of poorly. And specifically, the legislation will allow companies to pass sensitive user data directly to the government without a judge's oversight. And that's the part that I don't like.
I agree.
And I have the wrong mic up for you. And Charlie, one of the things that was pretty clear in the comments and some of the other stories is that the industry at large is saying, the companies at large can say, oh, we can neutralize the content of, you know, the information about the individual people. We can make it generic to still be successful at detecting threat levels. So basically, you know, scan through the data prior to giving it to the government, pull out people's names, pull out people's identification, except give some kind of link so that if it looks like, okay, there is a problem here, then a court order can be assigned with a lot of data behind it. And the court order, the judge can assess it and then say, yes, give that person's information out, right? So keep a buffer there. And I wish it was written that way. It's not written that way. And that's the problem with it, really. It's one of the problems. There's actually quite a few problems with it. But the general thing that seems to me that happens is we get legislators trying to solve the problem. The problem is that they're not trying to solve the real problem. They're trying to solve the fear that people have about the problem, right?
I agree.
So that's what the legislation is. It's not motivated from like, let's figure out if we can solve this problem. It's, oh my gosh, people are really scared. Let's do something. It's just so frustrating. As a technologist, understanding these things at a relatively deep level, I think that I wish that the people that are actually writing this legislation would spend the time necessary to understand the details of this. And I'm glad that it will look like it gets vetoed. It will get vetoed. I think it's a bad one. I just wish that people are a little bit more aware of what's actually happening. And the threats we're talking about are like denial of service attacks, scanning, the propagation of worms. All these things are because of the complexity of the technical space. It's extremely hard for people to understand what the heck is going on.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels to just the general problem that we've come to with tapping phone lines,
yeah,
and the warrantless, you know, wiretaps that we now all live with, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's the same thing. It's like, what was wrong with the court having to approve things beforehand?
Yeah.
But
and this law specifically, it provides an exception to existing laws that protect people, right? So it opens holes up in existing laws, and that's the thing that's and I don't think there's a necessity for that. So that's really frustrating. So that is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. We could probably do an entire show just on the details of what the law is actually doing and what it means. And that's the thing that, please, let's understand that it's an extremely technical space. It is scary, but it's something that, if it's understood well, better decisions can be made. And so spend the time to understand. In any case, that's a bit of my rant. Now, I'm excited because in the last few months, my son has actually got into building his own computer. So I've got my old Windows machines that I don't use very much. We've installed Ubuntu on them. We've got the graphics cards we're already swapping out. We're having driver problems. It's kind of a mess. And for my girls, the younger ones, they're the same age, instead of dealing with that level of complexity, having more Linux and Windows machines around, at the beginning of the year, we just got Mac minis for them. And I have to say, it's been very nice. It's easy, a lot simpler for me to manage. You know, my day job is technology, and sometimes I don't want to actually be doing that. You know, the cobbler's kids have no shoes kind of thing. Any case, but every time I chat with you, you talk about the newest computer and what's working and such. So what's your most recent computer success story?
Okay, yeah, well, it's interesting. About 2 years ago, I did buy a new motherboard and some memory and wanted to upgrade my computers. I've always put together my own computers. I mean, I just, you know, want to buy a nice power supply and such. And it's just kind of, you know, reasonably fun. But then it's gotten more and more complicated, of course, over the years. So I actually sat on this for like a year and didn't put it together because it just seemed too daunting and I was too busy. So I actually had a friend of mine do the initial just put everything in the box, and I think he installed Ubuntu, and you know, got it home and left it to me to install Windows 7 and all. The whole daunting part was that I had an XP system with hundreds and hundreds of programs, lots and lots of tweaks to the system to make it really usable and friendly. But then, as what always happens with Windows systems, they just degrade with time, and things get slow. And yes, I do registry, you know, cleanups and stuff like that. But it was clear that there were some hardware problems going on, and it's really hard to pin those down. So I decided it's just better to get new hardware. So I did this. So I put the hardware together. It had a few strangenesses along the way. I used a solid-state drive, as Lyle had recommended. But it had a very bizarre side effect that when I installed Windows 7, it put the boot sector on a spinning physical disk.
Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. And the catch, it was a really funny catch 22. This was it wasn't even formatted disk. It was a 3 terabyte drive. Well, what did Windows do? It went and automatically created a 2 terabyte partition because that's the largest it could do, installed.
For XP?
No,
for the boot 7, sector.
For the boot sector. And so it does boot up. I mean, so the Windows was installed on the, quote, C drive, which was the you know, solid-state drive, right? But then I went and took that other drive out of the system. And because
it didn't work.
And all of a sudden couldn't boot. And it was like, what the, you know. So anyway, when I finally figured out what was going on, and, you know, and I did a partition copy to a smaller drive because it was locking out that other terabyte because of the way they boot. Windows installs, there's a different way to format your drive if you want to utilize all 3 terabytes. So anyway, so that was weirdness number one. So weirdness number two was that I was getting instability, and I was getting crashes now and then, and et cetera, et cetera. And Firefox started, like, crashing all the time. And I'm going, what? You know, that's the most stable program I've ever had. So eventually, you know, so I'm looking on, you know, what you always do, you know, go to the forums, you know, go find out what's going on, learn how to debug Windows crashes, right?
Yeah.
And along the way, somebody said, oh, yes, and be sure to run memtest 86 and check your memory.
That's always a good thing.
Oh, duh, yeah. You know.
And?
So I did that. So what I had was 4 chips. It was a 4x4, 16 gigabyte, you know, memory module, you know, package from Corsair. I like Corsair, you know, good company, right? The fourth chip, and it happened to be just by luck, it was the last one, was complete crap. It, you know, ran, so memtest 86, by the way, is the standard for testing memory. And their new way, just to divert a little bit, is you download the ISO image. So you can create a bootable drive, a bootable CD. And so you don't have all the side effects of trying to deal with memory testing under Windows or something like that.
Right.
And so I ran that, and it was like 500,000 errors. Boom.
Oh.
You know. And so I isolated the bad chip, knocked it back down to 8 gigabytes. It ran fine, you know. Contacted okay. Corsair. They replaced it. I've got my 16 gigabytes.
Okay.
It hasn't crashed
okay.
in 2
Charlie,
weeks.
Charlie, is this... was the joy of discovering what the problem was worth all of that? Meaning,
a very good question.
That's one of the things I'm struggling with, right? I had a great experience building computers. You know, I did that for years. I loved it. And now, doing it feels like a chore. But I see you... You know, when you came in the day... when I came into the station the day that you had just... figured out the memory thing,
right.
You were a glow.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, it is funny because, quite frankly, the best way to learn is from your mistakes.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well, do you think that was your mistake?
Well, it was my mistake for it.
Not to test
here's,
it.
And here's the bottom line. When you build a new computer, even when you buy one, and if you're doing your own installations and stuff, the first thing you do is run memtest. Make sure your hardware is solid.
All
your
right.
drive, you know, run tests on your hard drives. Make sure your hard drives are good, you know.
So I've been doing, thank you, Charlie, for the update on that. Oh, so what are you suggesting for a motherboard right now? If you're going to buy a brand new motherboard for a home
Well, actually,
home
I
computer.
Can't right now because they've improved a lot. So this one's a 2-year old. Well, the system I got, I went to AMD. It was a good price for, let's see, it's a gigabyte motherboard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an AMD 6-core chip.
So I've got here on a note from you, is an NVIDIA GeForce 660. Was that the motherboard? Or
oh,
the
no, that's no. actually the graphics card.
Graphics
so that's
card.
Another thing. So the graphics, the gigabyte, and I, you know, can't dredge up, it's UE with a lot of numbers, you know,
yeah.
motherboard, which is pretty good for the time. And that's a good company, I think, for motherboards.
Yeah.
I do like them. And it, they were actually, but you know, angling towards the AMD graphics cards. And so it had an AMD graphics chip built into it, and I had a cheapy little AMD card, and this thing Crossfire where
yeah,
you kind of link
yeah.
the two together.
Sure.
But I ran some graphics tests, and it was pretty poor. And so my goal was to make making this new machine was really for Photoshop and Adobe, well, for Premiere.
Yeah.
So the
video,
video and mm-hmm. editing and the photography editing. So I started looking up, you know, well, what's the best boards for them? And it turns out that they really favor NVIDIA rather than the, you know, AMD, mm-hmm. You know. So in investigating that, I spent a lot of time, and the ones they have a list of officially sanctioned boards.
Adobe does,
yeah. But they can't test. They don't have the people to test all these boards. So obviously, there's going to be hundreds of boards.
You always
there.
Wonder in that officially endorsed is that because NVIDIA gave money to Adobe to say these are
Probably.
The ones, or you know, who knows yeah. what the motivation
well,
is.
Well, even within you know, so the 680, so the NVIDIA 680 kept coming up as a really good board, but I think that's around 400 or something,
right?
You know, and it's it
so you
want
like a half the price kind of thing.
So
at the 660.
I spent a lot of time looking at reviews and stuff, and the problem is there's so many boards, and even within one model you'll get sub models. Okay, so I latched onto the 660 NVIDIA, and of course, you know, NVIDIA doesn't make the hardware, they just there's companies like EVGA and what are some
well,
of the other
NVIDIA makes hardware. I mean, they have
well
plants
but there's
places.
All these companies that mm-hmm. sell the NVIDIA products.
Oh, I see. You mean you buy it from somebody else's NVIDIA's chipset.
Exactly.
Right,
but it's
right,
chipset.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course.
Yeah, so I found one that... So the base price for the 660 was like $200, but for $30 more, there was a model that had like 10% faster clock speed. And
you geek.
And it's like, you know, just a little kind of pushing it. And I'm not even getting into overclocking. All these boards, you can theoretically overclock them.
Right.
You know, and I haven't gotten there yet.
All right. I recommend not overclocking. Exactly. Once you get to that point, you start putting your computer in a fish tank and pouring oil in. It's just a mess.
I agree with you. I don't go there. Yeah. But I got a good compromise. And when I ran the graphics test, it flied.
Right.
You know, I mean, 192 frames per second on the 3D, test, you know.
So, okay, cool. Thank you so much for the update on the graphics card as well. I think building your own computer is definitely a wonderful experience. And that's why I'm doing it with my son, right? Like, and I hope to do it with the girls too when they want a faster machine. That's the way we'll do it, because I want all of them to have the experience of understanding, oh, this is the actual place that storage is. You know, when you open a computer, you can actually see all the parts.
Exactly. Yeah.
It becomes much more clear. So I've got another couple computers waiting around for the girls when they're ready to start hacking on their machines as well. All right. So last night, in a fury of, hey, everybody, give me some feedback, I went ahead and posted on Facebook, hey, give me content. And Jory Hendrickson, and also an earlier story from Mark, came in as well. Jory posted a whole bunch of stories. And one of them, of course, was one I would have covered anyway because it's such an interesting idea, and that is that Twitter recently, and thank you, Jory, for posting all these, Twitter recently launched a music service. Have you heard about this, Charlie?
No.
Oh, okay. So music.twitter.com. Twitter, of course, is, I'm not going to go into the details of that, but music.twitter.com is basically, you can authenticate your Twitter account and actually approve that you are who you are, right? So a lot of musicians have done that. A lot of popular musicians have done that. And so they have a Twitter account. And because they have been authenticated, if you will, you can link their Twitter account to the music that they play. And in doing that, you get some kind of interesting effects. If I, for example, follow someone, let me see who I'm actually following. Last night I turned on some musicians to follow. I follow Devo, of course, because we use Devo every week, so I got to use Devo. So Devo's got their Twitter feed, and when you look at the Devo Twitter feed, they, you know, add music, they talk about any, featured photo at Club Devo, so they're just, you know, it's updates on their website and such. So basically, and Elvis Costello, of course, is probably every time he goes to a new venue or releases a new album, you get to follow that. And so you basically have a connection with Twitter.
So are they giving you links to music you can listen
to?
Is that
so
the point?
That's the real point.
In other words?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The real point of it is that with all these musicians, you can play tracks of theirs through this interface, which the preview track comes from iTunes. So iTunes has all of this music. They play 10 seconds of any song you want on the planet, right?
Okay.
And then you buy it after that. But there are also services, Ardio and Spotify. Now, these are monthly services you pay for, and they let you play any music you want while you're in the service. And this is kind of an amazing feature. I think Spotify is the one that Ben Jaffe loves so much. Mm-hmm. The general idea is that once you've enabled the service and you pay for it, you can play any songs you want. So when you're then playing in the Twitter music space, if somebody's released a new song, you can play it, right? So it becomes your radio interface. I'm surprised Spotify is supporting it in some sense. And if you have a Spotify or an RDO account, you link your those services through the music, iTunes, the Twitter music system, and you're able to kind of synchronously or completely without stepping around play music through this system. Now, Twitter has a new website for this called music.twitter.com, and it uses your feed, your normal Twitter linking. But for you to actually play the service, you have to authenticate the music app, if you will. And then on iOS devices, they have a new music Twitter app that you run, and it works a little differently than Twitter. So they base the same content results from each other, but they're actually different systems. It's kind of neat. The way they do the authentication is just like any authenticate through Twitter system. So anyway.
This is an Android app too, it must be, right?
Actually not yet. That's one of the big things.
Really?
Why didn't you do that Android app? Oh. Yeah, they didn't. I mean, it is, you know, double the work to some degree to do that kind of thing. So in just a minute, we're going to be chatting. We're going to get another story from Ben on space and some other stuff about Apple and your phone, the phone you like. And maybe we'll even do some updates about Yahoo and such as well. So please do stay with us here on KUSP on GeekSpeak.
Hey there, guys. So I got a little bit more space news for you. In fact, I have a Mars-specific one. So Mars, if you're listening, you'll be happy to know that you're going to be spared a comet impact. A little while back, we found that there was a comet on its way to Mars, and it looked like it was potentially going to actually hit it. But of course, we've been observing this comet more and more and tightening exactly its trajectory, and we figured out that it's not going to hit Mars. It's going to just pass very close. This is going to be October of 2014. It's good news for Mars. It's also good news for us because it's going to be really pretty. It's going to be letting loose a lot of gas and gravel and ice, which means it's going to be very pretty. However, of course, this is bad news for anyone who has hardware around Mars. If any of this stuff comes off of the comet, it might actually hit one of our spacecraft or pieces of hardware, satellites around Mars. And since it's going about 50 kilometers a second, the teeniest thing can totally wipe out any of our spacecraft. So we'll just cross our fingers and hope we don't lose any things and enjoy the view. Now, I have one more piece of less fun news. NASA's 2014 budget came out back in earlier in April. And the gist of it is we have more money for asteroids and looking at asteroids and tracking asteroids. We have less for planets and a lot less for education. So I would say that's pretty bad news. But to put this into perspective, very recently, the president of Russia, President Vladimir Putin, said $52 billion is going towards their space program over about 8 years. So they're really investing in their space program. Personally, I'd like to see us invest a little bit more in the space program, especially given how much money we put into things like national defense. But I mean, on the other hand, at least we're spending a little bit more money towards tracking asteroids, considering that asteroids, if they get pissed off, are the things that actually could really adversely affect Earth or potentially even wipe us out. Anyway, that's my space news for this week. There's a lot of it, and I'll throw it back to you, Lyle. Oh, and by the way, Canada says hi. That's where I am right now.
Thanks, man. Tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project, the music and culture of the Emizir people of North Africa, otherwise known as Berbers. Moroccan Emizir musicians Fatah Abou and Mohamed Awalou join KOSP's Robert Polly for a conversation and a studio concert featuring beautiful vocals, accompanied by instruments like oud, sintar, and rubab. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on 88.9 KOSP, and also kosp.org. It's Geek Speak. And I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Charlie Manske. You can learn more about what we're talking about up at geekspeak.org. You know, another comment, and this will lead into your story about your phone, Charlie. Another comment from Jory suggested that take a look at this whole story about Apple and Siri. Released recently, Apple suits saying, yeah, we cache the Siri requests. We keep them because we need to keep them for a little while. They keep them for 2 years. So all these conversations you're having with this virtual thing, everything, the recording, the translation of the recording, that's all being saved by Apple for long periods of time. So think about that when you think you're interacting with yourself and a pseudo, you know, an AI type system, you're actually also logging everything you say to Apple.
So when I swear at my phone, they have it all, right?
You know? Right. And then depending on new legislation, that might be completely available to anybody.
Right? Oh, Jesus.
Do you assume that you're going to be swearing at your phone? You don't use an iOS device.
Well, actually,
right?
When I would swear at the phone is my old phone. So I had a Motorola Globe, Droid Global, and it really was terrible for the voice commands. And so I would say, call Dawn, and it would come up with the most wackiest thing. It would pull somebody out of my contact list. And so I'd get pissed, and I would swear at my phone because it's, you know, not going to be offended. So you could have some fun. Yeah. So anyway.
Let me see your phone right now. Hand it over to me while you talk about
it. Okay, right. So I got a new phone.
Oh, it's all shiny. It's giant.
Yeah. Okay, I highly recommend. It's expensive, but it's...
Okay, don't talk about price because we don't do commercials.
Okay, good. Okay. Right. But the Galaxy Note 2.
That's
and I know everybody's talking about the Galaxy 4.
I don't know. I can't keep track of these things.
Yeah, the Galaxy 4 is coming out. But that's the same size as the 3 and the 2. And it's a very good phone. But the Galaxy Note, there was a Note 1 came out with this big format. It's like a 5.5 inch screen, I think.
Yeah, it's big.
It's very big. It's a man-sized phone. Okay, that's the thing. I was really klutzy with the little tiny keyboards on the screen with my old phone, and I picked the Global too because it had a physical keyboard, had the little slide keyboard, and those are getting hard to find. And
this does not have a slide keyboard.
It does not have it, no. So it has, but it has a pen. That's a stylus. And I was a long-term user of the old Sony Clié in the PDA days when they weren't phones. And I really like the stylus. It's just much more accurate. So
it's like the tapeworm kind of stylus. Well, that's a real stylus.
It's a real
stylus. That's a real pen.
Actually, it's a real pen. And it has a nice kind of a springy touch to it. It even actually has a proximity thing. So it'll and if you just float above the surface, it somehow triggers things and everything. So anyway, I actually haven't used the pen a lot. It's you can write notes. It will do pretty good scribbles to text conversion. And so that's decently done.
It's got pressure sensitivity. I could use this for drawing.
It's actually apparently it is a...
Wacom.
Yep, it's got a it is Wacom technology.
Okay. Yeah. You just sold me on this phone because it's got a Wacom tablet. I do a lot of sketching and stuff. This phone is it's huge. You said a manly phone. I think that's not very descriptive.
Big clunky fingers.
It's a big giant phone. How about that?
It's a phablet.
It's like a tablet.
That's
it's
what
definitely
they call
like a tablet. So this is the Verizon Galaxy Note 2. Verizon's your network. Sorry, it's made by Samsung.
Right,
so
exactly.
It's a Samsung Galaxy Note 2, and you happen to use Verizon.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this thing, the drawing capabilities of it, I've got to say, are impressive.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm kind of hooked. I don't like the app I'm using, but then again, this is using like Jelly Bean or something?
Yeah. So it's a quad-core processor. It's very fast. And
Jelly Bean is the
faster.
Android OS, right? So you can update this.
Android, yeah.
This is an open source operating system, and you can update it at your leisure. Is that kind of right, or do you have to like crack it to put something else on it?
No. You can get the regular upgrades of the Android system, yeah.
I love it. I'm sitting here drawing a picture. I should draw you. All right, so it's got amazing tech specs and all that.
Yeah.
You know, it's so hard to say. Okay, let me just say this about where we are right now. This is Earth Day is coming up on Monday, right? And what do you do with your old phone?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that when I got
it. It works,
phone.
Right?
Yeah, I'm using it as a MP3 player.
Yeah.
Dawn's using it for that too, for her old phone.
I get
the apps still work, that just doesn't connect to the network.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's just suggest. Get the new technology, fine. But not everybody's affording the new technology. This thing's expensive, for example. So take the old technology and try to get it in use as soon as possible. Don't put it in a drawer and wait for months. And I'm talking to everybody. I'm not just trying to lecture to you,
Charlie.
No,
I agree with you. If you want to get rid of it, get rid of it so somebody's going to recycle it and reuse it.
Most all places that will take your phone, like if you go down to a big outlet store that actually sells phones, they'll actually take in your phone as well. And they will send that off to a recycling place. One of the first things they'll assess is whether it's reusable, and they will just reuse it. Of course, it's the best type of recycling,
Absolutely,
right? Where you don't destroy it and take it apart. You just wipe the system, put a new SIM card in it, and hand it off to the next user. So I urge you for this Earth Day to think about that old technology you have. Try to get it back into the system as quick as possible so that more people have access to technology. We don't have to buy as many new devices. That's, I guess, the best you can do. So will you do that this week? We take your old phone and get it recycled?
Sure.
And you can, of course, give it to somebody you know if that's the process as well. But then you've got to do tech support, which is always a dangerous thing to do.
True.
All right. I got to say, so I haven't told this pretty much this because I don't want to be kicked out of the system, but I did an If You Have Glass posting. And basically a while ago, Google Glass is this device that you attach to the side of your head. It's a pair of glasses basically that has a heads-up display. And there's probably a lot of NDAs about it and all that. So when people actually set into the system, they have to be very quiet about it. It's been very secretive. And a while ago, Google Glass, the Google project just said, hey, you know what? If you say, if I had glass, and a hashtag, if I had glass on Twitter or Google Plus, give us an interesting, compelling story. We're going to select the best stories and allow you to participate in an early adapter phase. So mine was, if I had glass, I'd make, and basically I described this app that when you go to a gas station, you would take a picture of the gas pump after you pump the gas and if your odometer, and it would auto-calculate how much gas mileage how the gas mileage has been.
Good.
Right. So it's one of those things. I take pictures all the time with my phone, and so I can calculate it out, but it takes some time. So that was my idea. And they responded, Google responded, hey, you've been selected for the early adopter. So I'm in the early adopter phase. I'm all excited.
Congratulations.
Except I do need I assume they haven't released a lot of information about it. I do need an Android phone. I'm an iOS guy. Now I've got a broken iOS 4. So, iPhone 4. So I think that I might get one of these. So yeah, maybe I should take your old phone. That's what I should do.
You want it?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Hey, sweet. Solve that problem. So when I actually get the actual detail from Google, I probably won't be able to say anything more about it.
I've been following this because it really is exciting. I'm definitely interested in that technology. Yeah.
And it's creepy, right? I mean, it's in the sense that when you interact with somebody that has Google Glass, and I know a couple of people that do, there's this little display. And instead of pulling things out of their pockets and looking at the screen, they look at you and then they kind of glance up and daze out like they're... Like they've got a mental
Now, have you tried
problem.
One on? Actually?
No, you can't try them on. That's part of the process.
Oh, okay.
Is that right now, only people that get them to try them on. And also, they lock them to your Google account. So it's not like it's a personal... It's even more personal than a phone in that sense, right? Mm. You don't share it. You don't unattach it and reattach it to something else. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. So that's the Galaxy. So your Galaxy Note 2. Maybe I'll do that. You know what? I wish I was in that public space where Samsung would send me one. That'd be
no
easy.
No kidding.
Thanks you for that. But the stylus is definitely the thing that would sell me on it because I do a lot of drawing. All right, Charlie. Thank you so much. Now, a while ago, one of the big news headline stories was that Yahoo's CEO Marissa Mayer said, she implemented a new paradigm at Yahoo. You have to come into the office. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was
dumb.
Yeah, that was a lot of people's response. That's dumb.
I worked at Netscape for many, many years, uh-huh. and I came in once or twice a week, and I was one of their most productive engineers because I could do it at home for ridiculous hours and not spend 2 hours, 2.5 hours a day commuting.
Yeah. So this policy was implemented, and then there's a lot of argument against that argument like that, right? Like, wait, I can be more productive when I'm alone. There are amazing tools and services to allow you to collaborate. I mean, I know programmers that do pair programming. That means that two people are programming at the same time and they're not in the same location, right? So they are working on the same document and compiling applications and doing all this work remotely from each other and talking the whole time and very effectively. And anytime they need to get up and do something, they can. So I recently switched jobs, and part of my process is that I get to work 2 days at home, and that's controversial in the company I work at. And this story, of course, led that to even more controversy in the sense that, yeah, how do you know people are working? But I would argue that even at work, you don't necessarily know people are working, right?
I've heard lots of interviews of people who have analyzed this.
Yeah, okay.
And they came to the conclusion that you get more distractions at work.
Yes. Okay, so Marissa Mayer, the CEO of Yahoo, finally on Thursday had a public presentation, and she started out by saying, okay, I'm going to address the elephant in the room. And so her quote, people are more productive when they're alone. Sounds good, right? But they're more collaborative and innovative when they're together. She explained that some of the best ideas come from pulling two different ideas together. And I agree. Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. So then you would argue, well, you want to do both. You want to have some time together. She's staying firm. The policy's not changed. You're going to the office. And now keep in mind that there's only like 200 out of 12,000 employees that were telecommuting, right? So it's not in the sense that it totally changes the culture to have everybody. Well, when it's 200 compared to 12,000, that's not a lot of people that aren't there. And so, but in any case, Yahoo office, of course, they're in Sunnyvale, and they're also in Santa Monica and San Francisco and Burbank and San Diego and Hillsborough and Florida and Orlando, I think, in New York City, right? So it's not like they're just closing down to some area of the country that you have to work there. They're like, you know, Redmond or something. But I think almost a lot of companies have major offices.
So they still have to solve the problem of communicating multiple sites.
Yeah, but if you're on a team, the team maybe all exists in one location.
Mm.
So I found this whole story really interesting from the get-go. One more thing, I'm going to close out the show with a kind of a personal story because I figure that's kind of interesting, what Lyle's doing in his job and such. And
yeah.
I volunteered two nights ago, on Thursday night, I volunteered to host a meetup. And if you go on meetup.com and you look for Lyle, you'll see the meetups I'm involved in, Lyle Troxell. And the meetup that I did was at the PayPal offices, which is kind of near the airport in San Jose. And PayPal, and of course, eBay owns PayPal. And the group is the Great Web Debate. And it's basically the idea is to get together influential web developer groups and talk about a topic and debate it. So the panelists, and I was the moderator and the host. And this video, when it's online, I'll share it. But the companies involved were Netflix, Facebook, PayPal, eBay, and also Pivotal Labs, which is a development company in San Francisco and other places that I've respected for a while. The thing that was really interesting was that we heard a little bit about how the internals work at these companies. To me, Facebook is this completely opaque thing that we chat about all the time. But there's this, you know, lead developer, manager person, Julia Lee, who was talking about the internals of Facebook, and it was completely different than I thought. Hmm. It is one of the things she said that the entire audience went, and I did that too, was that they don't have a QA process. What? Facebook doesn't have a QA process in the traditional sense of a QA team.
Right.
What they do is they do test-driven development. This means you build out from the base. The first thing you do is you start defining what would be a success and a failure, and you codify that in code, and then you make your system. So by the time you're running your system, you have tests against all the possible problems. So let's take a general idea is that I'm going to accept an email address to a field. This is a general idea. How do I test whether the email address is good? So you write the test to define if this test passes, then the email address is good. So you put in a bad email address, you put in a good email address, you try all these different derivatives, and then every time you change your code, you run that test suite application. And by the end of that, if it passes, you know that that field will accept email addresses, right? That general paradigm, when you do that at large scale, is an amazing way to develop software. It's also called I blanked on the audience as well. It's a behavior-driven development. So the idea that you want this kind of behavior, so you define the behavior first, and then you develop to that behavior. Additionally, the teams are extremely nimble. They're small groups, like 4 or 5 people, and they move throughout the company, and they can change any part of the code they want with a good amount of reason. And then when they deploy, and also when Netflix deploys, they deploy in batches and let the audience try it. Then they look at the metric to see how it affects the system, and then they determine if they're going to use it or not. So they're testing, if you will, the possibility of it functioning at large scale, which because they can do that with millions of users. So
that was actually pretty smart.
It was pretty smart. I liked the talk and it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. So you need to see the insides of the company. So that's the kind of that's a little update for me. All right. I just want to let you know that you can learn more about GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org. In the air with me was Charlie Umansky. Charlie, of course, is a biologist, programmer, and a radio producer. Thank you so much, Charlie, for being here today. Really
appreciate
it. Thank you. You can learn everything that we talk about at geekspeak.org. At the end of the show, we put the notes and such. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. You can follow us and like us and all that up online. Just go to Facebook or Twitter or whatever and look for KOSP Geeks and you'll find us, I promise.